Chapter 40. Solicitations voiced repeatedly at length have shown the soundness of their shape and left me no denial. You, at times, my dear one, have been used to handle it. My brother Joseph, years back, frankly gave his honest view that something should be done, and he, you well know, shows no ill taste in his regard of you. Josephine, and what princess? Napoleon, for wiving with? No thought was given to that. She shapes as vaguely as the veiled Josephine. No, no, it's Alexander's sister, I'm full sure. But why this craze for homemade mannequins and lineage mere of flesh? You have said yourself it mattered not. Great Caesar, you declared, sank sunless to his rest, was greater deemed even for the isolation. Frederick sought to, no heir. It is the fate of such, often, to be denied the common hope as fine for fullness in the rarer gifts that nature yields them. Oh, my husband long, will you not purge your soul, to value best that high heredity from brain, to brain which supersedes mere sequence of blood, that often vary more from sire to son than between furthest strangers. Napoleon's offspring in his like must lie, the second of his line, be he who shows Napoleon's soul in later bodiment, the household father happening as he may. Napoleon, smilingly wiping her eyes, little guessed I, my dear, would prove her rammed with such a charge of apt philosophy, when tutoring me gay arts in earlier times. She who at home coquetted through the years in which I vainly penned her wishful words, to come and comfort me in Italy, might, faith, have urged it then effectually. But never would you stir from Paris joys, with some bitterness. And so, when arguments like this could move me, I heard them not, and get them only now, when their weight dully falls. But I have said 'tis not for me, but France goodbye an hour. Kissing her. I must dictate some letters. This new move of England on Madrid may mean some trouble. Come, dwell not gloomily on this cold need of waving private joy for policy. We are but thistle globes on heaven's high gales, and whither blown, or when, or how, or why, can choose us not at all. I'll come to you anon, dear. Staunch Rouston will light me in. Exit Napoleon. The scene shuts in shadow. Seen via Vimiero, a village among the hills of Portugal, about 50 miles north of Lisbon. Around it are disclosed, as 10 on Sunday morning strikes, a blue army of 14,000 men in isolated columns, and red army of 18,000 in line formation, drawn up in order of battle. The blue army is a French one under Junot, the other an English one under Sir Arthur Wellesley, portion of that recently landed. The August sun glares on the shaven faces, white gaiters, and white cross belts of the English, who are to fight for their lives, while sweating under a quarter hundredweight in knapsack and pouches, and with firelocks heavy as putlocks. They occupy a group of heights, but their position is one of great danger, the land abruptly terminating 2 miles behind their backs in lofty cliffs overhanging the Atlantic. The French occupy the valleys in the English front, and this distinction between the two forces strikes the eye. The Red Army is accompanied by scarce any cavalry, while the Blue is strong in that area.
Dumb show, the battle is begun with alternate moves that match each other like those of a chess opening. Junot makes an oblique attack, by moving a division to his right. Wellesley moves several brigades to his left to balance it. A column of 6,000 French then climbs the hill against the English center, and drives in those who are planted there. The English artillery checks its adversaries, and the infantry recover, and charge the baffled French down the slopes. Meanwhile the latter's cavalry and artillery are attacking the village itself, and, rushing on a few squadrons of English dragoons stationed there, cut them to pieces. A dust is raised by this ado, and moans of men and shrieks of horses are heard. Close by the carnage the little Massera stream continues to trickle unconcernedly to the sea. On the English left 5,000 French infantry, having ascended to the ridge, and maintained a stinging musket fire as sharply returned, are driven down by the bayonets of 6 English regiments. Thereafter a brigade of the French, the northernmost, finding that the others have pursued to the bottom, and are resting after the effort, surprise them and bayonet them back to their original summit. The seesaw is continued by the recovery of the English, who again drive their assailants down. The French army pauses stultified, till, the columns uniting, they fall back toward the opposite hills. The English, seeing that their chance has come, are about to pursue, and settle the fortunes of the day. But a messenger dispatched from a distant group is marked riding up to the large-nosed man with a telescope and an Indian sword who, his staff around him, has been directing the English movements. He seems astonished at the message, appears to resent it, and pauses with a gloomy look. But he sends countermands to his generals, and the pursuit ends abortively. The French retreat without further molestation by a circuitous march into the great road to Tours Vedras by which they came, leaving nearly 2,000 dead and wounded on the slopes they have quitted. Dumb show ends and the curtain draws. Act 3rd, Scene I, Spain. A road near Astorga, the eye of the spectator, rakes the road from the interior of a cellar which opens upon it, and forms the basement of a deserted house, the roof doors and shutters of which have been pulled down and burnt for bivouac fires. The season is the beginning of January, and the country is covered with a sticky snow. The road itself is intermittently encumbered with heavy traffic, the surface being churned to a yellow mud that lies half knee-deep, and at the numerous holes in the track forming still deeper quagmires. In the gloom of the cellar are heaps of damp straw, in which ragged figures are lying half-buried, many of the men in the uniform of English regiments, and the women and children in clouts of all descriptions, some being nearly naked. At the back of the cellar is revealed, through a burst door, an inner vault, where are discernible some wooden hooped wine casks. In one sticks a gimlet, and the broaching cork of another has been driven in. The wine runs in two pitchers, washing basins, shards, chamber vessels, and other extemporized receptacles. Most of the inmates are drunk, some to insensibility. So far as the characters are doing anything, they are contemplating almost incessant traffic outside, passing in one direction. It includes a medley of stragglers from the Marquis of Romana's Spanish forces, and the retreating English army under Sir John Moore, to which the concealed deserters belong.
First deserter, now he's one of the 81st, and I'd gladly let that poor blade know that we've all that man can wish for here, good wine and buxom women. But if I do, we shan't have room for ourselves, eh?
He signifies a man limping past with neither firelock nor knapsack. Where the discarded knapsack has rubbed for weeks against his shoulder blades, the jacket and shirt are fretted away, leaving his skin exposed.
Second deserter, he may be the 81st, or th-82nd, but what I say is, without fear of contradiction, I wish to the Lord I was back in old Bristol again. I'd sooner have a nipperkin of our own real Bristol milk than a mashed up full of this barbarian wine.
Third deserter, 'tis likely to be ungrateful, after putting away such a skinful aunt. I am as much Bristol as thee, but would as soon be here as there. There ain't near such willing women, that are strict respectable to, there as hereabout, and no open cellars. As there's many a slip in this country, I'll have the rest of my allowance now. He crawls on his elbows to one of the barrels, and turning on his back lets the wine run down his throat.
Fourth deserter, to a fifth, who is snoring, don't treat us to such a snoaching there, mate. Here's some more coming, and they'll sight us, if we don't mind.
Enter without a straggling flock of military objects, some with fragments of shoes on, others barefooted, many of the latter's feet bleeding. The arms and waists of some are clutched by women as tattered, and barefooted as themselves. They pass on. The retreat continues. More of Romana's Spanish limp along in disorder. Then enters a miscellaneous group of English cavalry soldiers, some on foot, some mounted, the rearmost of the latter bestriding a shoeless foundered creature whose neck is vertebrae and mane only. While passing it falls from exhaustion,
The trooper extricates himself and pistols the animal through the head. He and the rest pass on.
First deserter, a new clashing of feet being heard. Here's something more in order, or I am much mistaken. He cranes out. Yes, a sergeant of the 43rd, and what's left of their 2nd Battalion. And, by God, not far behind I see shining helmets. 'Tis a whole squadron of French dragoons.
Enter the sergeant. He has a racking cough, but endeavors, by stiffening himself up, to hide how it is wasting away his life. He halts, and looks back, till the remains of the 43rd are abreast, to the number of some 300, about half of whom are crippled invalids, the other half being presentable and armed soldiery. Apostrophe, apostrophe, sergeant, now show your nerve, and be men. If you die today, you won't have to die tomorrow. Fall in. The miscellany falls in.
All invalids and men without arms march ahead as well as they can. Quick ma WWCH.
Excellent invalids, etc.
Now. Tension. Shoulder RR fallocks.
Order obeyed. The sergeant hastily forms these in two platoons, who prime and load, and seem preternaturally changed from what they were in two alert soldiers. Enter French dragoons at the left back of the scene. The rear platoon of the 43rd turns, fires, and proceeds. The next platoon covering them does the same. This is repeated several times, staggering the pursuers. Excellent French dragoons, giving up the pursuit. The coughing sergeant and the remnant of the 43rd march on.
Fourth deserter, to a woman lying beside him, what do you think of that, my honey? It fairly makes me a man again. Come, wake up. We must be getting along somehow.
He regards the woman more closely.
Why, my little chick? Look here, friends.
They look, and the woman is found to be dead.
If I didn't think that her poor knees felt cold. And only an hour ago I swore to marry her.
They remain silent. The retreat continues in the snow without, now in the form of a file of ox carts, followed by a mixed rabble of English and Spanish, and mules and muleteers hired by English officers to carry their baggage. The muleteers, looking about and seeing that the French dragoons gave in there, cut the bands which hold on the heavy packs, and scamper off with their mules.
A voice behind, the commander-in-chief is determined to maintain discipline, and they must suffer. No more pillaging here. It is the worst case of brutality and plunder that we have had in this wretched time.
Enter an English captain of hussars, a lieutenant, a guard of about a dozen, and three men as prisoner.
Captain, if they choose to draw lots, only one need be made an example of. But they must be quick about it. The advance guard of the enemy is not far behind.
The three prisoners appear to draw lots, and the one on whom the lot falls is blindfolded. Exeunt the hussars behind a wall, with carbines. A volley is heard and something falls. The wretched in the cellar shudder.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.